Accession number 14995, Reel 2.
Air Commodore Roberts, Reel 2. What happened to Dinjan Airfield later?
Yes, well, after about three months, it was decided to give that part of India, or hand over India to the American Air Force, and they've helped them with their, give them a firm base there to carry on the supplies to Chiang Kai-shek. And they were, in fact, attacked after we'd left. They were attacked on one occasion, I believe, but I don't know. I don't heard a hearsay at all.
You were telling me that you also had a flight to Fort Hertz in
I took over with Hawker Ordrax. They are very simple Hart variant aircraft, and we had dropped some airborne parachute engineer to make a landing grounds there, which they signaled back when they'd initially made it, and so I flew over to test it, and just on one occasion.
Did you ever come across the Japanese Air Force at all?
Not at all, no. Not on those occasions, no.
How did you like doing this work in Assam?
Well, it was a great experience. I liked it in a way. I never liked flying over the jungle much. My experience previous overseas flying has always been over the jungle, and the conditions are quite different. And if the system was, if you force landed in the desert, you must never leave your aircraft. You mustn't start to walk on your own in the desert, otherwise you'll never get anywhere. So we must always stay their aircraft. Now, if in the jungle, if you went down, you had to get out yourself. Nobody would find you. So we always flew with a belt. They gave a belt of silver rupees, 100 rupees, ransom money. If we fell in the hands of the Nagas, and we carried a Gurkha kukri, so to help yourself get out of the jungle. We never had to do it, but that's what we carried.
Did you carry a survival kit?
No, I don't think we did. I can't remember.
Now, to go on to our third subject, which is your period in Russia in 43-44, mm-hmm. Can you tell me what your job was and why you were sent, please?
Yes, I was sent there in charge of the air mission we had there, and my also position under the Foreign Office was as air attaché. We at the Air Force had kept on attaché position, whereas the Army and the Navy gave up their attaché jobs. I don't know why. They're all part of the same mission. But we had quite a big staff there with the signal side, intelligence.
Um, Yeah. Were you able to have much contact with the Russians themselves?
A certain amount. They were, but only through a special liaison office with the services. They were a very interesting time with the Russian army. They had just managed to take up the original ranks of the Tsarist army. I think, I have an idea, previously they hadn't, didn't have ordinary ranks. The badges of ranks were ordinary chevrons on the sleeves. And I think it must have been after the victory of Stalingrad, which is just earlier, not long before I got there, that the high Soviet command must have managed to get Joe Stalin to agree to them taking up the Tsarist ranks again. And so they became very rank conscious. And they were very conscious of making their officers into cultured chaps, from rather than being rough peasants. And an interesting point, I think, when I got there, they had a general appointed to conduct the improved status of the Russian officers, and he was quite unique because. And when the revolution took place, he was serving as the Russian Tsarist. He was a Tsarist officer serving in Paris of the military Russian military attaché. And he's an aristocrat. I think he was served in one of the Tsarist regal cavalry regiments. He was very well born chap, and uniquely, after the revolution, he didn't give up. He's a Russian citizenship. He returned to Russia and made a successful thing. And he became a major general, and he was given put in charge of this sort of cultural education. Their paper called the Red Star was the Russian Army paper. And they had a large week to read long articles on how things used to be and how officers could get themselves. And quite usually, in some ways, we found afterwards they took up the old Tsarist
Tsarist ranks?
Yes. And customers. Yes,
the
regal army's customers. Customs. now, unique. When we had Latterly, when I was out there, I did a with my staff, some of us, we went to the East Prussian front in Lithuania. We went there, went to visit Scotland there, and I remember we were taken by air and staged through Minsk and Vilna, and I remember we were in Vilna airfield waiting for clearance to go forward to this forward landing guard where the squadrons were, and we had got talking to a very scruffy junior lieutenant with an old-fashioned transport aircraft with a red flag order on the side, which he was very proud of, and we got talking to him, and we noticed he was talking to my deputy, who was a wing commander. He was wearing battle dress in those days, with shoulder straps, and talking to my deputy, who was the wing commander, and this chap was talking to him in second person singular, which is a way of an officer talking to another rank. And he thought that he had this three bars on his shoulder, that he was a sergeant. And that was quite unique.
Did your deputy take offence?
Not at all, no, he laughed. No, because it was quite a big shot to the chap when he told him that he was a Polkovnik, yes.
What impression did you get of the East Prussian front when you visited?
Well, fine, good, full of spirit, yeah, very interesting chaps. Not very, they weren't operating hard all the time, they were waiting for another punch, so they were just going into East Prussian then.
Did you have anything to do with the air attacks on the Tirpitz?
Yes, we did. It was on two or three occasions, it was decided to attack the Tirpitz. The Navy evolved these miniature submarines, and they wanted to attack with the miniature submarines, and to get Rakotin's photographed of the Tirpitz and its mooring defences. We sent from United Kingdom from Benson was the headquarters of the photo reconnaissance units, send a detachment of their special photographic spitfires out, which they could only just get to Murmansk via the Shetlands. They sent up to Sumbra in the Shetlands, and from there they flew, they could just reach Murmansk Vanga airfield, and they could operate, and they came over, and they could do their photographic cover from Vanga, and which they carried on for a certain time until the initial submarine attack on the Tirpitz. And so they couldn't fly the aircraft back, so they were handed over to the Russians, and the chaps came south to Moscow by train, and then we sent one south about to the Middle East to get home. Now, that was the first strike. The next time was the attack was going to be meant. The most successful one was when 617 Squadron from Bomb Command attack with these special Barnes Wallace tall boy bombs. So they wanted photo reconnaissance again, which they sent some more Spitfires out and more chaps. And it was quite amusing when they found their old Spitfires had been used by the Russians for in a bit. Obviously, they'd been tipped over on their nose and things, noses. One aircraft has had its propeller replaced with a Catalina. Catalina propeller. And all their wheels were changed too, and they had Yak-Shu. But the rich Russians have been flying them.
What was your own role? What job did you have to do in relation to the Tallboy attack on the Tirpitz?
Well, not on the part of the administration of the photo recce boys. On the signal side, yes.
Was all well in relations between the British and the Russians, as far as you could see, through the Moscow embassy in collaborating with each other as allies?
Well, and I found out, I got there in July 1943, the liaison side was rather difficult. They wouldn't cooperate very well. They were, as allies, we found that they were very difficult. And the reason was they were very dissatisfied with the conduct of the World War on the other side of Europe, that we had attacked through Italy and hadn't attacked, invaded northern France. And the generals, complained was, when were you going to stave the second front? Когда будет второй фронт? All the time. Initially, now when I went out there initially, we went out with the Trades Union Congress. Walter the Stream. The Trades Union Congress. I remember he telling us he was taken around a factory, and what chap was doing, putting tires on wheels in a motor factory, and this chap was deaf and through a drum, so all he could do is to communicate with the deaf and drum land. And so Walter said, what is he saying? And he said, he wants to know when you're going to stay at the second front. And that was the thing that was going on. And they were very difficult. Right until we hit November. November 43, the foreign ministers' conference was staged. And that was Anthony Eden was our foreign secretary, and Cordell Hull was the American one, and Maltos was the Russian one. And Eden had come out with a lot of the plans of the second fund, and he was so that satisfied the Maltos or Sultans. After that, they were much better. But it was quite interesting. I went to a big Kremlin banquet, and while he was there, which was quite interesting.
While who was there?
Well, Eden, and he was. I was complaining when he came to see us in the office. I said, "Well, how difficult they'd been." He said, "Oh, everything is going to be all right now." And everything was they changed completely and became very cooperative. And I was an Irishian. They invited me to go to this banquet. It was tremendous. So, and we met Joe Stalin, and they were Stalin, Molotov, Voroshil, if I remember, Mikhail Yan, I think, was the trade commissar, and one or two other ones. It was really a big do. When I was this big, long banquet, very long table, and I being a junior boy right down the end, and there were one or two American correspondents with me. And the banquet was long. We drink toasts all the way through. Speeches and toasts all the way through. I saw the Americans come also at the same time as Cordell came out. Cordell Hull came out. Harriman came out with him to take over being American ambassador. I also, they would decide, Americans would decide to set up a mission like we had, and so brought a general and various officers with him. And I remember this general, I can't remember his name now, Curtis or somewhere, I can't remember who he was. He was gave some speech, which all had been interpreted, of course, sort of thing. And he must have said something that appealed to Joe Stalin, because I think this was a procedure that they knew all about it, what Joe's did, and so he went all around the table, round past me, and a flunky with a tray of drinks or a drink for him anyway, round here, came out because he wanted to drink a toast with this general stuff. And I'm an awful stout, okay, because this is well on to the festivities. Maybe the big shots were rocking a bit, and Harriman was overwhelmed with delight to see this Joe Stalin drinking a toast with his mission commanders. So he came along and said, Marshal Starling, says, Marshal Starling, I drink for you, to you. See, and Joe put down the glass and say, j'ai vu pil, I've already drunk, and turned around and went back. And Harriman was absolutely left in the air.
So it was a snub.
It's awful, yes.
Your ambassador was...
Yes, my ambassador was Archie Clark Carr. Sir Archibald Clark Carr, he's a magnificent chap. Quite unique in many ways. It was in the summer when I got there and first met him. And Moscow summer is quite hot. We wore a khaki drill there. Archie Clark Carr, he used to sit out, do all his work out in the garden, completely bare, except for a pair of shorts. And now he loves sunbathing. He did all his work outside without a shirt or anything on. And another customer with him that held his minutes. All his writing was done by a quill pen. Always use a quill pen for everything.